Welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today, it is Girl Power Day. You've got me, Lauren Williams, and my fellow female consultant, Megan Landris, and we are going to be talking all things recertification and PSLF waiver. So if you're worried about recertifying your income and how it's going to work if you're on an income-driven plan, stay tuned for just a second. And also, if you have got lots of questions, which everybody does about the PSLF waiver, how it works, what we need to be doing, what we should be thinking about, we're going to cover it. Let's take it away. Megan, how are you doing today?
What's up? I'm looking forward to our conversation today. As always, I think we're always excited to kind of digest some of this really complicated technical information to bring it to you to help answer your questions that you might have. Thanks for having me join you.
It is always fun when there's more than one. Let's kick it off by talking a little bit about self-reporting on income-driven repayment plans. So people are probably like, what? What does that even mean? How do you self-report with an income-driven repayment plan?
Yeah, so that is literally never really been an option, except for, you know, alternative documentation. Technically, when you update your income on an income-driven plan, you can submit alternative documentation, which usually is in the form of a pay stub or some kind of confirmation of your income, which could also be a signed statement. This isn't totally foreign, but it is more easy to do at this point because of this COVID forbearance that we're in is kind of our rationale. But right now, within studentaid.gov, if you were to go and recertify or apply even for an income-driven plan right now, it will give you two options. It'll allow you to, usually it used to make you link back to your most recently filed tax return through the IRS data retrieval tool. That's always been the case. Now it gives you a second option to self-report your income for the income-driven repayment application. So that's something interesting because, again, usually it had to be a little more structured or formal. So you could choose to do either. Have you actually seen the language for this, Lauren, or had clients talk to you about it?
I have not seen it as of yet, but well, I've seen it in our situation. We do a lot of back office sort of things to make sure we're up to date on everything, but I have not seen it in a consultation. When you're doing your actual IDR application, that when you get to that step two part of things, it's going to say income information, and there's a button where you can select, I'll report my own income information. So that's how it looks as you're going through the actual process.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And like you said, this does expire, according to Student Aid, July 31st, 2022. Now, some language or technical language just to be aware of is if you do self-report, it's going to ask you for your gross income. So that's the language that they use. But usually when you update your income or you link back to a tax return, it pulls through your adjusted gross income from your federal tax return 1040. So that's something to be aware of. They're asking for gross income. Usually if it's reported, you know, through the tax return, it's taking AGI. So just maybe keep that in mind. I don't know how important that language is exactly, but it's something that I've noticed.
Yeah. Do you think it's like a typo that, like, we know that the federal government is not perfect, so somebody might have put the wrong thing there. And it's also hard for people to know what their AGI is, but if you put gross income and they calculate a payment based on gross income and you're maxing out your retirement plan, this is not going to work in your benefit. So self-reporting is not like the cool, fun thing to do to get the lower payment per se. You could actually mess it up and end up with a higher payment, right?
Right. And I think it's done for ease because a lot of folks just don't know what adjusted gross income is. I mean, that is a tax term. Mm-hmm. So if you're not sure how to derive adjusted gross income, I think that's why they have gross income put in there, because it's just simple. Like, what is your salary or what is your gross income? Most people know that right out the gate. That's my assumption. For folks whose tax return, for whatever reason, just has not been able to pull through, I've been telling folks to put adjusted gross income. I don't think that's unethical. I don't think that's lying. I think that's what would have literally pulled through on the tax return if they were to use that option. By no means am I saying lie on this document or this option. Absolutely not. Do not lie. But I think if you know exactly what your adjusted gross income was for this prior tax year, 2020 or 2021, if we have that exact figure, I think it's okay to go ahead and plug it in there.
I think that's a perfect segue into our next topic, because so many people are like, it's a new year, it's time to do taxes, but also usually I have to recertify my income. So which tax return should I be using? And when are they going to ask me when to recertify my income? I'm so confused about what's happening. Like, I'm excited that I don't have to pay my student loans at least until May, but what's going to happen with my recertification?
Right. Gosh, recertification, like, this has been, I think, the bane of our existence. Yes. Recently too, because we do a lot of planning off of when someone has to recertify, and it's continuously been changed or altered because of this COVID forbearance. Mm-hmm. But their most recent language on studentaid.gov says that you will not be required to recertify your income before payments restart. So as we know, payments have been extended to May 1st. So no one's going to be required to recertify before then. And then it goes on to say, and the earliest you could be required to recertify is November 2022. They pushed this again. Originally, or, you know, I think last time we did this, actually, Lauren, it was saying August. So they pushed this again to November 2022, likely because they pushed the extension since the last time we chatted or exactly. On the podcast, I mean. So what does that mean? So that means if your normal recertification is anytime before November 2022, or sorry, any month before November for this year, then you are not going to have to update your income. It will be, your recertification will be postponed 1 year or 12 months. Let's maybe talk about an example if you want to maybe set the stage, Lauren.
Well, yeah. The first thing I want to say is that your income being postponed is not the same thing as your payment being postponed. What's going to happen is your pre-COVID income-driven repayment amount is what is going to kick in May. And then you won't be asked to recertify until 2023. So in this example, your current recertification date is showing as October 1st of 2022. That's going to be pushed out to October 1st of 2023. In May, you're going to have whatever last recertification you did, which was probably pre-COVID, assuming that you did not do any certifications during COVID, you're going to pick up where you left off from that time going forward. Now, what people want to know is, like, when it is finally time to recertify, am I going to do Mary filing jointly, Mary filing separately? If this is all being stretched out for such a long period of time, maybe I can get away with filing jointly this year if I need to file separately overall for my student loan strategy. So what do you think this person should do in this situation, Megan?
Yeah, so filing separately is always a strategy, or is a strategy we talk about if borrowers are married. And this is because when we file taxes separately, if we're on pay as you earn or income-based repayment or income contingent repayment, these plans allow you to exclude spousal income from your payment. So it's a lot of times a really great planning strategy to try to keep our income-driven payment as low as possible. But filing taxes separately can sometimes not be as tax advantageous to us as filing taxes jointly. So, you know, the discussion we have in our planning sessions is, you know, does the savings that we reap by filing separately in our payment benefit us enough to cover the cost of what it is to file separately, or what the difference is between joint and separate for our tax filing? And so if we are filing separately because it does save us enough overall, do we need to file separately for 2021 taxes now? Because thinking about this same scenario, this person, their old payment is going to kick in starting in May, and it's going to go all the way until October 1st, 2023. So with that being said, when they update income October 2023, the most recent tax return at that time would be 2022, actually. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't be 2021, the one that we're about to file here right now. So in this scenario, it could maybe make sense to go ahead and file taxes joint, take advantage of maybe the more positive filing joint status from a tax perspective, because it's not going to impact your payment until 2023. But at that point, we would have already had another tax return that we could have filed separately for. So in this example, I would say might make sense to go ahead and file taxes jointly if it makes sense from a tax perspective to do so for 2021, and then pick back up with filing separately starting 2022 taxes. Is that what you would say as well?
Yeah, that's definitely what I would say in this situation. And this is why strategy is so important, as thinking about, you know, what am I going to do to maximize the efficiency and the cost related to paying my student loans back? We've had a really cool opportunity to optimize things over the last year and a half. But now that things are kicking back in, you're going to have to be more active in your strategy. But there are tons of things you can do to make sure that you are, you know, optimizing your household income, optimizing your financial plans overall. And like you said, this Mary filing jointly in this particular situation we're deciding could save you a lot of time, save you some money on taxes, and be just a more efficient way to go about life. One of the things that I've seen in this whole recertification situation, though, has been people are like, well, I'm still confused, Lauren, because my date says 2022. So you're telling me that they're saying we don't have to recertify by until November of 2022. But when I look at my file or I look in the studentaid.gov website, it says March 2022. And I'm confused because I think I should turn in my paperwork. They even say on the studentaid.gov website that you may still see a recertification date that is earlier than November 2022. So they're giving us this warning that, hey, we haven't figured it all out yet. This is actually what we're going to do. So don't be alarmed when you look at your aid summary. We are working to get everything updated. We thank you for your patience. Look at them being nice to us on the studentaid.gov website.
Right.
So if your recertification date falls between now and November 2022, it will be pushed out 1 year. So they put it there. We're not making this stuff up. This is what studentaid.gov is telling us.
Right. One other thing to note. So if you're asking, how do I figure out what where my recertification date is anyways, you could give your loan servicer a call. That's an option. I know that's probably a very unattractive option because you might sit on hold for a bit. Or you can go to studentaid.gov. You would log into your account there. And what you want to look for underneath My Aid, so you'll see, you can click on the drop down where your name is towards the right of your homepage. Click on the drop down, click on My Aid, and then there will be, you know, some details that pull up about your loans. The language, it should say something to the effect of, you know, loan details, where you can click on the loan details. It'll pull up a list of your loans. Then you can click on each individual loan for additional loan details on that specific loan. So go ahead and do that. Find just one of the loans. Click on the loan details again, and it should tell you your IDR. So IDR for income driven repayment anniversary date, or it'll say recertification date, something like that. And it'll tell you the month and the day and the year of your recertification. So again, remember, if it's still showing before November 2022, Student Aid has advised that they are working on getting that pushed back 12 months. If it's already showing 2023, then you'll have a very good idea of knowing like when you'll have to update in 2023. So that's how you can find your recertification date if you don't already know it. I might double check it anyways, since they have made adjustments to recertification dates and anniversaries during this COVID forbearance. It's possible it's not what it used to be. So maybe go and double check even if you think you know it.
This is all super duper great news. And if I'm a listener on the other end, I'm like, okay, thanks, Lauren and Megan. You've made it so clear for me. You have quelled my anxiety. I am feeling much better about my overall student loan situation. And I know what to do leading into recertification. However, there are some other people who are pretty anxious right now, and we've been getting lots of consultations related to this subject. So let's transition to talking a little bit about the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Waiver and some of the things that have come up because, you know, news is unfolding every day. We're learning new things every day. There are updates happening all the time, and we've got a couple for you.
And yeah, so we're going to continue to talk about the PSLF waiver because literally we've been stalking the studentaid.gov website on like frequently asked questions, like additions that they add to the website, because we think this is such a huge opportunity. Like they definitely underestimated how many people that this could impact or help. So we want to try to get the message out there to so many people on how we can best take advantage of this PSLF waiver. One big thing that we as a team have been toying with the language on, or kind of wrestling with planning strategies on, is the fact that you can consolidate your loans to take advantage of this PSLF waiver, which some people might have to because they have those FFEL loans or the family federal education loans or Perkins loans that previously have not been eligible for PSLF. So that first requirement to getting those eligible for this PSLF waiver is consolidation. So that's why this, of course, is relevant to start off. But then we started to learn that there was specific language on studentaid.gov. I'm just going to read it verbatim. We've talked about this a little bit already, but I want to make sure the language is pretty clear. So one of the questions under studentaid.gov, the PSLF waiver information site, says, how many payments can I get if I consolidate loans with different numbers of qualifying payments? And Lauren, how many times do you talk with someone who has different payment counts for different loans towards PSLF?
OMG. I would say like 99% of the time we have seen someone, even if it's just like a difference. The client I had yesterday was 74 and 75. Like half of the payments were 74 and half of them were 75. And it's like, how did I do all of these loans the exact same thing and one payment is missing? Sometimes it's much more egregious where it's like 55 and 72 or something, and there's no reason, rhyme or reason for it, and they're confused about it.
So common reasons why this can happen, just so you are aware, are graduating with different classes of loans in the sense that, let's say we had undergrad loans and we have graduate school loans. And maybe we took a year off between undergrad and grad. Well, undergrad loans, those loans already had a grace period after your first undergrad graduation. So that 6-month grace period would have lapsed. You would have probably entered repayment for a period of time before you went back to grad school. Fast forward to graduating from grad school, your grad school loans did not have that 6-month grace period. So the grad school loans will continue to have the 6-month grace period where the undergrad loans may not. So if you think you entered repayment, and let's say we did not consolidate right after school, if we thought we entered repayment on all of our loans after graduate school, like right after grad school, we may not have, because the undergrad loans were eligible to enter repayment right then, but the graduate school loans were not. So that's a very common example that we see, where if someone did not consolidate, they have a larger payment count on their undergrad loans, maybe 5 to 6 payments more than their graduate school loans. So that's one example. And then, you know, just of course, the similar like thought process is if we did go to school at different periods of time, but we went into repayment on our older loans for periods of time before school started back up. So those are some pretty common reasons why we see payment count differences. But then, of course, there's the other times where it just doesn't make sense to us, like a direct consolidation loan having two different payment counts. Like, how does that happen when it is the same consolidation loan and they just separate unsubsidized and the subsidized loans? Like, what?
It is crazy. It's just like unbelievable. So let's go to the language then. I'll read what it says here about... So it's, how many payments can I get if I consolidate loans with different numbers of qualifying payments? That's the question. It says, as long as your repayment history overlaps for each loan, the consolidation loan will be credited with the largest number of payments of the loans that were consolidated. For example, if you had 50 qualifying payments on one subsidized Stafford loan, and 100 qualifying payments on another subsidized Stafford loan, and you consolidate those two loans, you will receive 100 qualifying payments on the new direct consolidation loan. Megan, what does this mean? Is this like a huge deal, excellent, or is this like, meh, this is just okay news?
So it can be a huge deal. And why that is? Well, one, this would be very frustrating. If we had one loan that had half the payment count of the other for maybe seemingly no apparent reason. So let's say, you know, this person didn't even have, you know, weird breaks in our schooling or in our payments. Like this just doesn't make sense if you've supposedly been in repayment on all of your loans from the get-go. So this consolidation conversation could fix that. If the PSLF waiver, like them going back and reviewing your payment count, won't fix it automatically. But where we're starting to see this as a really interesting planning situation is when, let's say we went to undergrad in 2010, we graduated, made 5 years of payments, went back to school for 2 years, 2 or 3 years for grad school, borrowed again. We have, you know, another couple years of payments before we went into the COVID forbearance. Well, if we worked in public service that entire time frame, so for our undergrad payments or for even grad school, if we went to grad school multiple times, if we had always worked in public service while we had made payments historically, with the normal PSLF rules, those older loans would have a much higher payment count towards PSLF, where our newer loans, of course, would not have, it wouldn't have had a chance to have that same payment count because they didn't exist before then. But they would have, in this example, would have overlapping payment history. So let's say they were in repayment all at the same time, you know, 2018, 2019, before COVID happened. They have overlapping payment history. So what we have literally been seeing is people consolidating their loans with this situation, their undergrad and their grad school loans, just going ahead and consolidating now and getting credit for what the oldest loan's payment count was, even though those grad school loans didn't exist. But does that make sense how I'm explaining that so far?
Yeah, totally makes sense. But I know people are just like mind blown, like, wait, what? How is this possible? So basically, if you're not catching what she's putting down, then or catching what she's throwing, if you will, then 5 years of payments on some older loans. Now, all of a sudden, you got these new loans. You typically on those new loans would have to do 10 years on those loans. And 5 years from now, the old loans would have gotten forgiveness because the total amount of time that needs to be made on each loan is 10 years. So you would have two staggered amounts of time that you're doing this whole public service thing. Instead, you're doing a consolidation and you're catching all the loans up to the same place. And some loans that wouldn't. So basically, you're shortening the amount of time that you're going to have to continue on in public service and shortening the amount of time until you get public service loan forgiveness. It is a game changer.
Yep. You know, we're not sure if this was intended. We don't know if it was thought through when this
Sorry.
I know. No take backs, because we've literally seen people getting the credit and getting the, some folks have gotten immediate loan cancellation, even though, again, the older loan or the, sorry, the newer loans that they had couldn't have existed for 120 payments yet. But this consolidation kind of loops them into the rest of them. So it's very interesting, very unique. It could help someone accelerate their PSLF timeframe dramatically. So this is something that we've been keeping an eye on. We've been, you know, looking at text files for to make sure that this is actually how it's playing out. And so far, from what we could tell, it is. This is a big deal. This is why we wanted to talk about it again today.
So this is a super cool opportunity to have available to you if you are a part of the public service loan forgiveness system and you're trying to figure out, you know, how to get access to the waiver and how the waiver might be helpful to you. If you've got tons of loans that are in different situations, this could be a great opportunity. But a key piece of this is going to be overlapping payments. So can you talk about how overlapping payments work, Megan?
Yes. The first sentence that this Q&A has is, as long as your repayment history overlaps for each loan, the consolidation loan will be credited with the largest number of payments of the loans that were consolidated. So overlapping payment history. This is very important. In our minds, we're thinking that this means we had to have at some point been in repayment status at the same time as those older loans for the newer loans. I would not implement this, or we don't think it would be applicable to a situation where someone maybe just graduated from grad school like this month, and they go ahead and consolidate all of their loans from undergrad that were 5 years ago, for example, and they had payment history on those prior loans. Reason being, we don't have payment history yet for that brand new loan. So what we've been talking about is checking to make sure that you do see on your federal file or just in your payment history that you were approved for an income-driven plan or you were approved for a repayment plan in general at the same time as your other loans being approved for a repayment plan as well. That we think is overlapping history. If you want to be extra safe, you can wait until payments resume in May and, you know, make a payment May or June. So we know for sure we have overlapping payment history on all of our loans. So that's some of the language that we've been wrestling with too, like as far as like how technical are they going to get with that? But I think those two characteristics would be important to keep in mind. Either we're approved for the repayment plan for all of the loans at the same time at some point in history, and or if we wanted to be super safe, make sure we make a payment here coming up in May, and then maybe look at the consolidation. Does that make sense, Lauren?
That makes sense. P.S. Dear Federal Student Aid, studentaid.gov, Office of Department of Education, however you'd like to refer to yourself, please feel free to clarify and make it easier for us because we're working diligently on behalf of borrowers over here.
Mm-hmm.
So last but not least, we wanted to talk about a letter that many borrowers have been getting as they go through this consolidation process, and it's super duper scary. So Megan, catch us up on what the letter says and what borrowers should not be worried about.
Yep. So a letter that we're getting a lot of people reaching out to us for is something that comes from Fed Loan Servicing. Has Fed Loan Servicing at the top and the U.S. Department of Education at the top. And then the like blurb at the top right says, are you sure you want to consolidate your loans? So basically the gist of the letter is, you know, saying, hey, there is an important update. On October 6, 2021, the Department of Education announced a change in the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program rules that for a limited time may allow you to get credit for payments you've made on loans that wouldn't normally qualify for PSLF. This waiver period is temporary and will end on October 31st, 2022. To gain more information on this limited waiver period, including any actions you may need to gain access to these benefits, visit, and then it gives you the web link for studentaid.gov/PSLF waiver. Now, as you go through the letter, it continues to talk about how you may want to leave the direct loans out of the consolidation if you already have direct loans because they are already eligible for PSLF. And then payments will count from the consolidation towards PSLF. So basically it's saying, and this is true for historically how consolidations worked, but consolidation used to erase payment history for PSLF. Again, that would be the case without this PSLF waiver. So the language in the letter is describing that there have been temporary changes to PSLF until October 31st, 2022. So how we're kind of tackling this question or this worry about, you know, oh my goodness, are you sure that the payments prior to consolidation are going to count towards PSLF is we refer to the specific language, again, on that same web link, the studentaid.gov/PSLF waiver, where it outlines which PSLF requirements are waived, and it shows us what's changed and unchanged since October 6, 2021. It lists out the normal PSLF requirements and what changes are in effect until October 31st, 2022. And one of those bullets specifically says that past payments made on loans before consolidations count, even if you were on the wrong repayment plan. So this confirms that past payments made on your consolidations will count until October 31st, 2022. So for example, if we were consolidating October 2023, like next year, then this would not be the case. This is only limited to this PSLF waiver period. But that is what we're pointing to just for confirmation on this not negatively impacting your PSLF payment count for any payment count that you might have prior to now.
And so this is exactly why the waiver exists, in my opinion, is because they didn't make it easy. And they're still not making it easy for borrowers to easily understand what they need to do and how to do it. the paragraph literally starts off like, hey, just so you know, there's this special situation, but also we're sending you this and we're going to scare the crap out of you in the next paragraph by sending you the language that is not really relevant right now.
Yep.
Yeah, this is literally why the waiver exists, because so many people got misinformation or confusing information on the front end way back in 2007 that they didn't get a clear opportunity despite having been in public service for the last 10 years. So thanks, but no thanks for this letter.
Right. I know.
Don't worry. It's okay to consolidate. There is documentation and we are seeing people, you know, like you said, actually consolidate and reap the benefits of consolidating loans in that situation.
Yep. So we're continuing to monitor all of these like technical questions. So if you do continue to have questions about this, you know, you can reach out to our info@studentloanplanner.com email. We'll do our best to try to answer any like general questions that come in through there. Of course, if you want to walk through your specific situation, talk through all the pros and cons for what we need to be doing with you specifically, then definitely, you know, look into scheduling a consultation with us. So our team, we've collectively worked with over 7,000 people now. So 7,000 cases. So we've seen a lot and we can help you navigate your situation specifically. So if you feel like you need a little more specialized or specific help, you could schedule a consultation with us through our website on the help tab that we have. But anything you want to add, Lauren, before we close out this podcast episode of us going through some technicalities again?
Nope, I think you nailed it. Don't be afraid of all the different intricacies. Just get help if you need it. We are here for you. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. This has been another episode where Megan and I have shared all the gems. Until next time, see you later.
See ya.